The hour of 12:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee. Members, today we have the Office of Higher Education. We have a technical glitch unrelated to the snowstorm outside, so we do have paper in front of us, and you will be asked to work off the handouts. So if they would, Director Pogemiller, Ms. Grimes, and Ms. Fergus, if you would come up and please identify yourself for the record, and then tell us which of the three documents you're going to start walking us through. Well, you're going to have to sit by a mic.
How about this?
So
how about that?
We want Director Pogemiller. I definitely want you on record. So,
well, Mr. Chairman, we'll try to do that. I think the slideshow looks like this: post-secondary education in Minnesota, House Higher Ed Committee, March 4th.
Got it.
And, Ms. Chairman, as I understand it, today, whoops, here we go.
There we are. Thank you. Once again, just good work.
As we understand, Mr. Chairman and members, today you're going to mostly focus on appropriations and loans and student debt and student financing. And I was going to just start out with a couple charts for context and then turn it over to our professional staff to go through the rest of things. First chart is appropriations for higher ed in Minnesota since 96. And the thing to note about this chart is that there are modest increases from 96 to 02, and then the recession hit, the 03-04 recession hit, and there were significant reductions, upwards of $170 million. And then 05 to 08, there are modest increases again. And then the next recession hit in 9, 10 through 12, where there are reductions again. And in the context of these appropriations, it's important to note that kind of significant increases in enrollment in the 2 years took place. And it started in 03 at the for-profits, and then it's really got going at 06 at MinSCU. And so in context, you need to look at these appropriations on a per-pupil basis, which is the next couple charts we're going to look at, based on fairly significant increases in enrollment and historic at MinSCU after 06. The next chart, then, is total appropriations, which is just the line graph for the previous.
The page is still passing out your handout, and it's very difficult to see on
the numbers
these screens,
are small, yes.
The size. So why don't we just stay here for a second,
okay?
And you can keep reviewing these while the members are getting their handouts, because the information is pertinent to where we will be going this session with and if we get a positive target.
We're optimistic that you will, Mr. Chairman. We hope.
I want to remind everybody the only reason we get a positive target is because revenue is raised. We are not going to raise tuition, I hope, in this committee. That would be my goal, Director Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, then, if members have that chart, again, just to summarize it.
Let's go back for a second. Members, we're working off the Post-Secondary Education in Minnesota, House Higher Education Committee, March 4th, 2013 packet. The first page just has appropriations, loans, and student debt, just a couple of bullet points. Then there's a chart, and Director Pogemiller has walked us through some general comments, which actually are important to the overall state of how we now fund higher education in Minnesota as a result of two episodes that have occurred, resulting in a what would be two recessions. They more or less melded together. But so do all the members have that in front of them? Apparently they do. All right, Director Pogemiller, then let's proceed.
Then, Mr. Chairman, on that chart again, I'll just point out from 96 to 2002, there are modest increases in appropriations for post-secondary. And then the recession hits, 03, 04. And during that period, there were significant reductions, upwards of $170 million. And then 05 through 08 were some increases again. Again, I think we should characterize those as modest. And then 9 through 12, there are reductions again. And again, fairly significant, $280 million over that period. And the other thing to note is that starting in about 05, coming out of that first recession, there were significant increases in students attending two-year colleges. It actually started at the for-profits in 03, and there'll be a chart later on. It's actually, you'll see it later on, but it's going to be page 27 of Minnesota Measures. It'll show that in 03, the for-profit population went up fairly dramatically, and the Minsky two-year went up fairly dramatically. And the biggest, in about 06 or 07, Minsky had its historic high number of students because of that increase. And it continued through about 9 or 10. The next chart, then, is just the line graph of the previous table. And you can see in the top total appropriations, this is non-inflation adjusted, that in about 02 or 03, it was $1.4 billion, $1.407. The high was in about 8, which is $1.563 billion. And then today, the last appropriation was about $1.28 billion. The next chart then starts to put that in context. This is the chart you've seen, I believe, from both Minsky and the U. And this is a per student. It's based on SHEO, state higher education officials around the country data. And it's inflation adjusted. It's per pupil or per student. And it's inflation adjusted in several ways, higher ed costs and CPI. And the chart you've seen is that there has been, Minnesota has actually had a slightly faster disinvestment than the rest of the country in the last few years. That's the red line. It's important to note that this is per student and that this is at the time from 03 to now to 10 where there were fairly dramatic increases in two-year students. So the denominator has gone up. The next chart puts that previous chart in a larger context over a longer period of time, over a longer horizon. So if you looked at this chart just from 09, I mean from 99, that would be the previous chart for the two dotted lines. What this chart does is take it back to 86 and then adds total revenue above. The importance of this chart is to remind us that the only source total revenue is tuition fees and appropriations. The bottom two lines are just appropriations. The top two lines include tuition and fees. So the intent of this chart is to remind us that the only sources of money in higher education are not appropriations. Matter of fact, later on as you get more into the debt discussion and you're going to find out that most of the money involved here comes from families, either through savings, current income,
or debt. Okay, I'm on page 6. I think
that's the one we're looking at.
Whoops, well, seven, it actually isn't, but
sorry. There's that. This is the chart I just explained.
Yes, and that's what I want to stay on for a second. How do you explain the revenue per student going up while the appropriation is going down and the two lines are going in opposite directions?
The top two lines, the solid lines, include tuition and fees, whereas the bottom two lines, the dotted lines, are just appropriations. And so the point of this chart is, to remind us that all the revenue in higher ed does not come just out of appropriations. Most of the revenue actually comes out of tuition fees and debt, through debt.
So, Director Pogemiller, it would appear that tuition was going up at a dramatically fast rate, almost as fast as the revenues were going down.
You can look at it that way, I think, and it's important to know
that. Well, Director Pogemiller, how would you look at it?
The only question I had there was the dramatic one. because depending on what period you're talking about, tuition may not have been going up dramatically.
Well, but
over the period, over a decade, it has gone up at three times the rate of inflation and three times the rate of family incomes. Tuition has. And what this chart tries to indicate a little bit, or allows you to notice, is that you would have just a straight line on the revenue on the two top lines, or on the top blue line, if the only thing being made up for was state appropriations. But the lines are higher than that, and so more than state appropriations has been made up for by tuition.
And that
reductions in state appropriations.
And we have had the university tell us, and we may be accused of taking the quote out of context, that they raised tuition because they could. The Minsky system is saying they did not, but these lines would indicate an incredible increase in tuition, simultaneous with cuts, and as you just stated, beyond what the cuts were. So both systems raised tuition beyond what was being cut because they could? Is that the answer?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to characterize why they did it. I think the facts speak clearly, though, that they have that tuition has gone up more than what would have been necessary to make up for just the reductions in appropriations. That's a factual matter.
Well, Director Pogemiller, since you're in charge of higher education and the governor's proposal that is before this committee in the legislature, it would appear that tuition may have gone up enough so that it would cover more than the cuts, then why are we seeking new revenue?
Well, two things you have to factor in, although these SHIELD ones are adjusted for inflation and cost. But the price of doing business at those institutions is a factor in, to the extent that they are dealing in a marketplace for faculty and workforce. And then secondly, presumably, the institutions are making some decisions relative to how they'd like to either maintain or increase quality by putting extra revenue in.
Director Pogemiller, during this time period, you told us that the two-year colleges were going up in tuition at a dramatic rate. Are you going to show us in this packet just how dramatic that was over the last 10 years?
The population is what...
No, I'm not talking about population. No, I'm talking about tuition.
Mr. Chairman, Trisha Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. We don't happen to have that chart in this packet, but we can certainly bring it on Wednesday. And I believe it's in Minnesota Measures also.
We'll get you a page on, I think you have Minnesota Measures. So what you want a specific chart on tuition increases at the institutions?
Well, we pretty much know, but it would be nice to review, particularly now that it looks like we're getting to the point where targets will be assigned to the various divisions. But the concern on this chart is the overwhelming discrepancy between the cuts and the tuition increases. And your comment that the tuition went up more than the cuts, and the explanation is a thin one. Somebody carried the burden here, and it appears to be a student. And in your packet, you're also going to give us a report on student debt. We're now seeing the outcome of the students bearing the brunt of this. You said students and families, so
yes.
It's both. But somebody pays for this.
Mr. Chairman, clearly that it's the evidence is pretty clear that that student debt has made up for the bulk of this at the end of the day.
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I just on page 5 that inflation factor there. I guess the thing that I guess I'd bring out is that the people paying the bills, the taxpayer and the student and the family, they've experienced this same decline in their purchasing power of their income, and I doubt if their income has gone up at the same rate as the tuition cost and their expenses in general. So I guess the thing to keep in mind is I understand why they increase this thing, but it's all why the colleges increase their tuition to a certain degree because of the cuts. But to me, if they were doing a good job, the tuition increases would have mirrored the decreases in state funding at a time when our economy was in a difficult situation, and you know, things were tight all the way around. It appears that the just keep on spending philosophy, regardless of reductions, and just tack it on to the student, seemed to be the primary philosophy at looking at these charts. And so do you have a response to that?
Director Pogonot.
Or am I drawing the wrong conclusion?
Director Pogonot.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it is true that, as I said, over the last decade, tuition and fees have gone up at three times the rate of personal income and inflation. It is also true that the tuition and fee increases have been greater than the dollars necessary to hold harmless from state appropriations cuts. Less factual, then, is the amount of increase over and above what would have been necessary to make up for appropriations. I think the institutions would argue that's a quality issue and an investment issue, and it's for you to determine if you agree with that or not.
Representative Gruden-Hay.
That's fine for
now. Representative Pop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that quality issue, if we also laid upon this chart, the chart regarding faculty and staff who were frozen for anywhere from 4 to 6 years, and administrative costs, which increased. The salaries for the administrators in Minsku, certainly Minsku, not going to speak about the University of Minnesota, but that would likewise be the case, but we know this to be true in Minsku, that the administrative salaries for presidents at least increased, I'd say, dramatically in some cases. So once again, the revenue gained by the students, they added on the debt. They increased the tuition, so they paid more, and the value actually went to the president's salaries. I'm not sure that it necessarily went to those who were doing the job of educating those students, the faculty, and or those who were in the support staff realm or those that helped to take care of the facilities.
Director Pogonot.
Well, Mr. Chairman, again, I believe this is for you to judge. Mm-hmm. I think it should be noted, though, that there was a freeze at Minsku in terms of salaries. The University of Minnesota, though, did choose to increase salaries during that period of time. And so I think it's important to make a judgment about the arguments that the institutions make about what they're doing with the money that they have over and above the replacement for appropriations. And I think obviously the university would argue salaries to be competitive and quality, and I think Minsky would argue quality. I think that's for you to judge.
Or Director Pogonot, the question is, did both systems raise tuition because they could? Because there was no oversight of what they were doing, and because of the recession, it increased enrollment. It was masked as they began to raise these tuitions. Is that a plausible answer also?
Mr. Chairman, you're trying to get me in trouble?
You,
Mr. Chairman, that is plausible.
Director Pogonot, your job is to be the spokesperson for higher education in this state, not to do anything else. And there has been an incredible increase in tuition and an incredible increase in debt and historic cuts. And now I want to know exactly how to start the remedy without just pouring more money in, because apparently money was poured in. Money was poured in by historic amounts here by the students. And it appears that hasn't solved the problem. So, Director Pogonot, I'm not convinced that just pouring more money in gives us anything other than what Representative Poppe and Representative Gruenhagen have already alluded to. And it's time now to have an accounting. And I don't want the accounting to be that we add more debt to the students, that we increase tuition to fund more new programs, because we can't support the programs that are here. That doesn't make any sense. Director Pogan.
Mr. Chairman, I think the most important insight that could be added here is that since somewhere around 80% of the money in post-secondary comes out of families, not from the policymakers, that you're in a market system that you don't totally control. And the professional staff in our office would tell you that they don't see over the long haul the correlation between appropriations and the setting of tuition and fees. In the short term, it may happen. For example, if you put in appropriation and cut a deal to buy tuition down or to freeze it, in the short term, there seems, you know, you can effectuate that. But over the long term, if you look at this, there does not seem to be a very strong correlation between where the price is set, the tuition level and fee level, with the level of appropriations. And so I think you've got your public institutions that are both in a more public system because they get more tax dollars. They get money through direct appropriations in addition to state aid. They're, even though they get more, they're still in a market system that they're trying to deal with for their workforce and the type of students they would like to attract to their institutions. And so I think you've got presidents of universities and chancellors and trustees and regents who are trying to balance the forces they're under in the market system to get the kind of students they think are best served at their institutions and setting the tuition fees at a level they think will do that. And so I think it's not as clean cut, in my judgment, Mr. Chairman. It certainly is important to notice that tuition fees has gone up at a faster rate than the reductions in appropriations. It is simply not just clear cut or factual whether that increase has effectively been spent. That is something that I think you've spent days on with those institutions to determine whether you think they've effectively spent that money or not.
And Director Polgemiller, I would agree with your first statement that there has been no long-term oversight of higher education. But frankly, at these salary levels, at these bonuses, there should have been. And particularly when we're looking at the increases that we're looking at over this time period, we paid them well to oversee these institutions. We paid them in trust to make sure that these institutions would be accessible and affordable. And I don't see accessibility and affordability here. I just see incredible increases in tuition. And the very group you're alerting to that were so concerned about getting the right type of instructor and the right type of administrator apparently failed to complain when there were historic cuts. Failed to complain that these tuition increases would have a detriment in the long term. That failure bothers me more than anything else, Director Polgemiller. And that now is going to be for the next generation to handle, because I think we've priced one generation out of higher education and we burdened one with incredible debt. And I don't want it to continue. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Polgemiller, is it your job or your department's job to make the decisions about tuition or spending for the university or the Minsku system?
No.
Director Polgemiller, is it, thank you, Mr. Chair, whose job is it, in your opinion, to set the salaries and make determinations about the budgets at the university and the Minsku system?
Director Polgemiller.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that the president and the regents and the chancellor and the trustees.
Thank Representative you. Norton.
Mr. Chair, I would say we're spending a lot of time and energy directing our anger at the wrong people. And I'm going to just say for the record today to all of us sitting around this table that we have a big responsibility, at least with the University of Minnesota, in choosing a Board of Regents. And we as legislators are held to a high standard by our constituents with an opportunity to vote or not vote for us every time we run for election. It is our job to have that same due diligence when it comes to choosing the Board of Regents. And this committee might want to think long and hard about the recommendations we're making to the floor, to the body, on Wednesday. And did we as a committee hold those folks to that high bar? And I would say we did not. So if we're going to sit and be angry, we need to look within ourselves about what kind of choices we're making moving ahead in order to make certain that the decisions that are made at the University of Minnesota, the Minsku level, are at the best level we, as legislators, can have them make. And I would say we're failing to do that. And so I want to hear the rest of this report, but I think our anger is focused at the wrong people.
Representative Norton, I would direct your attention, if you would, to the January 22nd The Regents Oversight Committee, the comments made by Senator Bonoff and myself, particularly my comments about the region selection process and the regions that were before us. You also know we had 5 hours of hearings with the University of Minnesota, and in those hearings we went over the current university budget. We also took a look at the Minsky budget in some detail to understand where this money had been spent and its impact on tuition, and we are going to continue to do so. I agree with you. I have said in my comments also there has not been oversight of higher education, I would say, about for the last 10 years, and that has resulted in this. That oversight is now going to start, and it's going to start in detail. And when we get to putting together the budget, I hope that all of the questions are answered so that we can direct at the problem that appears to be the most onerous, tuition. These tuition increases have created a system, and I'm going to repeat it, that has burdened a generation with debt and has also probably priced the middle class out of higher education.
Chair Pawlowski, I absolutely and completely agree with that, and you've heard me at this table make those same comments. But if this committee and this legislative body doesn't do the right thing in regent selection, it is our own fault.
And Representative Norton, the regents have met with us. You are going to have an opportunity this week to select a regent. You can select anybody you want on the floor, whether they were passed through the region selection committee or the joint committee. As I've said before, anybody can be a regent. And I hope that the next group of regents understands that there is a fiduciary responsibility, and we expect that responsibility to be upheld. Director Pogemiller, please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, in this book that you have, Minnesota Measures, this is on the tuition question. There is a chart, several charts. On page 16 is the tuition and fees chart from 99 to 2012. Page 16. And on page 33, it shows tuition increases relative to undergraduate tuition increases relative to income and inflation. Not income, just inflation?
Income, it's one line in inflation.
Yeah, income and inflation are on that chart. So page 16 are the published tuition fees for the various types of institutions. And then page 33, the chart on the left shows it relative to CPI and Minnesota income.
Thank you, Director Pogemiller. That's helpful. Proceed.
Mr. Chairman, then I was going to turn it over to staff to talk, to get into who pays and the other issues that you were interested in. I'll hang out and add if I need to.
Before you leave, to Representative Norton's first question, just what is the function of this office and your role?
Mr. Chairman, historically this office has supposed to have been the office that kind of advises the legislature and the state about higher ed happenings. It was made a cabinet level agency decade or 2004, so almost a decade ago. And I think that was an effort by some of you were here at the time. And I think that was an effort to more tie this office to the governor and the legislature in terms of providing advice, information, and policy direction. In addition, just managerially, we run the state grant program for higher education, and that's state grants that go to all sectors of higher education, for-profit, not-for-profit, public institutions. And we do policy analysis based on the data that's available to try to help policymakers understand what's going on.
Director Pogemiller, what was your role in Winona last week?
Mr. Chairman, after putting out his budget, the governor asked if myself and other commissioners would go out in the state and ask citizens about whether they thought he was hitting on the right things or not. And so for me, it was, I've been to, I think now, four locations in greater Minnesota to talk with students about whether they thought his combination of investments in Minsky, the U, and financial aid was kind of the right direction to go at this point in time.
Director Pogemiller, I read the article. So in that capacity, you were the spokesperson for higher education in this state.
the listener, at least, at that. Yes.
Well, you.
I'm representing the governor.
Reading budget. The article, I think you were a combination of both. Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I just think, just a little follow-up on this conversation or these comments. I think the accountability needs to be directed in both areas, both at the regents and at the individuals here representing the and presenting the information. One thing about the regents, it's without getting too lengthy, one of the reasons I didn't vote for any existing regents is because they were sitting on the regents board when all this was happening. So I think we need to clean house a little bit. So if Representative Norton would follow my lead on the vote on the House floor, I'd appreciate it.
Do we have any other questions? You're going to still be here,
yes.
Director Pogemiller. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Director Pogemiller, I don't know if you're the right person to answer this, but on slide 33, or page 33, your slide about undergraduate borrowing increased faster than tuition and fee rates.
And in Minnesota Measures, yep.
Yes, in Minnesota Measures. And your assistant?
Yes. I got it.
Okay. So as I look at that chart, it looks like tuition and fees are the lines represented by yellow, green, gray, and blue.
Correct.
And the red and the orange lines represent how the other two sources of funding for higher education. Is that a correct way to read that?
Director Pogemiller.
I think so, yes. They come out of per capita personal income, yes.
Representative Winkler. Oh,
Mr. Chair, Representative... Senator Pogemiller, I don't know if you're...
You're on the right-hand chart.
Director Pogemiller?
Yes, the answer is yes. You're on the right-hand chart, yes.
And I don't know...
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if senator or director is a higher position.
I think in this capacity, he's a director, but he never loses the title of senator, so you could go either way with that.
Okay. Senator Pogemiller is how I'm used to addressing him. But as I look at that chart, the conclusion, if you look at it simply, would be that federal and state financial aid and undergraduate borrowing are the funding sources together with modest tuition, but the overall cost increase in higher education, the dramatic increase has been in student borrowing and in federal aid, and the gradual tuition increases essentially are how those are paid for.
Director Pogemiller.
I think that's accurate. The big jump in financial aid is the Pell Grant was, I don't know if doubled is a little strong.
Doubled.
It's doubled in the last 5 years. But even then, the maximum Pell is $5,500. So it went from, I think, $3,500 to $5,500.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pogemiller, as I look at that, it kind of begs the question, is the increase in the Pell Grants and student debt permitting tuition to increase? Or is tuition
Director
increasing, and as a result, Pell Grants and student debt have to go up?
Director Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, there is quite a bit of research on this, and I think the weight of the research indicates that for most of higher ed education, that the financial aid does not drive price. There's some evidence that it might for certain providers, but in general, it's the other way around, that financial aid or grants are trying to keep up with prices that are set in a marketplace. There are some dissenting views on that, but I would argue, my judgment is that the bulk of the evidence is that the Pell Grant is not driving the price.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Senator Pogemiller. So that might lead to the conclusion that if we took actions to cap or reduce tuition, then student debt and Pell Grant usage might also flatten out.
Director Pogemiller.
Did you say, Mr. Chairman, did you say usage would flatten out? That depends on family incomes.
Representative Winkler.
I think the usage of or eligibility would depend on family incomes, what happening there, and the fact that family incomes were not increasing created more eligibility. But I think the conclusion would be that to the extent that tuition fees prices are slowed down, that Pell and state grants will start to help families catch up. And debt should come down a little bit because then there'll be a better matching of real market prices with the public's attempt to try to make it accessible across incomes.
So Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pogamel, I guess that's sort of a data supporting the common sense conclusion that if it's cheaper, people will have to borrow less to pay for it.
Director Pogamel.
Yes, I think that is probably what would happen. And the question is, can you keep up enough grant aid and suppression of price to allow them to start to come together and squeeze out the debt? That's the issue. I think one would want to be a little careful that the Pell is a really major player here in terms of state financial aid. There's a lot more money in Pell in Minnesota than there is in state grant. And so you would need fairly significant increases in state grant money to have that by itself start to impact that dramatically. But for individual families, depending on how much you do increase that state grant, can absolutely affect their choice. If you give a $1,000 or $1,400 increase in a grant to a particular family or student, that absolutely will be a trade-off on debt.
Mr. Chair, you know, I guess the conclusion, though, is that it, because the lever of the state grant is relatively small compared to the Pell Grant, it would seem like the only way to get a handle on debt would be to do a combination of the state grant and a reduction or a reduction in the increase in tuition in order to get a handle on debt.
Director Pogan.
Chairman, I think that's pretty accurate, yes.
And, Mr. Chair, I would observe that would be a departure in policy from what we've done for a long time, which is just to assume that the tuition can go up as high as it wants and we will catch up with aid and with debt.
Representative Winkler, it would be, and I think we are coming to a consensus that we have a tuition problem, and a big one. Proceed. Are you
Mr.
finished?
Chairman,
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe you answered this at the beginning of your response to Representative Winkler, but I'm studying the chart here on page 33, that the second chart that he was talking about, and looking at it in relation to the first chart and trying to understand that dramatic increase in student borrowing that is clearly outpaces tuition and fees. And can you give me your two-sentence response to why that's the case?
Ms. Grimes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Briner, one of the things that happened is that in 2008, the federal government increased the amount that each student could borrow. And they did that partly in an effort to make sure that students would be borrowing from the federal loan programs rather than private student loans, which carry higher interest rates. But that is part of the reason the line goes up so steeply from 2006 to 2010, sort of, is because the federal government increased the amount each student was allowed to borrow each year.
Representative Bryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is there any corresponding correlation reduction in hours worked outside of, you know, student employment or what's required for students to maintain, you know, their total package in terms of support?
Ms. Grimes.
Mr. Chair, it's not clear that there is a reduction in work. Also, over this period of time, there was a fairly steep increase in the price of textbooks, for example. And so there were other expenses that increased for students, even beyond tuition.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't expect you to give all that detail now, but I think that's something we need to understand about what's going on with that dynamic with student borrowing, student employment, and the total student package of costs.
Representative Johnson, and then I have Representative Winkler. So Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you expect, or can you tell me whether the cost of higher education, in particular the federal government grants and loans and such, are they affected by the current sequester and the next fiscal cliff?
Ms. Grimes.
What kind of hole will that leave?
Mr. Chairman, there's more slides at the end on this, but the 89% of all federal grants that come to Minnesota students are the federal Pell Grant. And the federal Pell Grant is protected from, is not included in the sequestration in the next year or two. However, it is subject, most of it is subject to appropriation. There's a little part of Pell Grant funding that's mandatory funding. And the current continuing resolution funding the federal government expires on March 27th. And so Pell Grants for next year really are not funded yet.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pogamel, does your office collect information about sort of where students are spending their money. It occurs to me we had a discussion, I think at our last hearing, about the significant increase in quality of undergraduate housing on campus. And I know there is always, you hear sort of anecdotal stories about, the reason why students are borrowing so much money is because of $4 lattes and not because of higher tuition. And, so there's sort of this anecdotal sense or this story that's told about kind of the entitled student who borrows heavily because the money's available and they don't realize that by borrowing so much and living so well at the age of 19, they are hurting their ability to live well when they are 30 or 40. And so do you have any, is there data on where students spend their money? Are we just, or, you know, do we need to protect them from bad financial decisions like we do vulnerable adults?
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Meredith Fergus, and I am a policy analyst at the Office of Higher Education. Representative Winkler, in response to your question, we don't specifically track where Minnesota students spend their money, as in we don't get diaries of spending. There are a couple of data sets we do access, though. One is the Consumer Expenditure Survey, which is national-level data that is survey data on how individuals spend their dollars, and we can look at that for students across the nation. We're not allowed to look. We don't have the ability to look at that for Minnesota students. We know that overall student expenses actually decreased during the recession. They were spending less on entertainment, apparel, those types of expenditures. Now that we're kind of more towards the 2012 side, we do expect that those expenses will start to go up again. We do also track the actual prices set for things such as housing by the institutions through the cost of attendance budgets, which are reported to the U.S. Department of Education. So if the University of Minnesota, for example, were to build a new dorm, their average dormitory cost would likely increase, and we'd see that reflected in that cost of attendance budget, depending on how that budget is set by institution. If the students choose housing that is off campus, we do see that in the fair market rent survey, which is Minnesota and county specific, which talks about what the average rent charge for a one-bedroom or studio apartment is for all individuals in that geographic area. And that is a survey of landlords or corporate housing kind of entities. In regards to the actual kind of phenomena that you're discussing, it's called premature affluence. It's where students spend much like they could when they lived with their parents, and they actually spend more while they're accruing their debt and then are forced to live within a constricted means after college. I read an article in About Campus just this weekend that, yeah, more students are actually seeing restrictions on their spending in the post-college years because they are using student loans to pay for some of that lifestyle type spending. I don't believe that all students live like that, though, but it is a phenomenon we do know of.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pogemiller, any policy initiatives to help students make better financial decisions when they're younger?
Director Pogemiller.
Ms. Chairman, Representative, there is an effort to bring financial literacy kind of to every home in Minnesota through various executive departments are working on this, commerce, K-12, higher ed. So helping students decide what level of debt they should accrue is an important initiative, I think, that we all should be thinking about. And a collection of this SLEDS data, state longitudinal educational data, to kind of connect which jobs are available with the kind of degree you're working on, will start to help provide information in more real time to students in the coming years so they can make a better judgment about that. Today, I think what we have is Minnesota students understand they need post-secondary education, and they apparently are willing to go into pretty heavy debt to get it. And we are trying to figure out a way to make sure, one, they don't just take the maximum levels of loans available if it doesn't fit the kind of job they're looking for. But secondly, I think the real issue here is we have not kept up with our level of public support with regards to financial aid to allow students the ability to avoid that much debt. Because, again, I just want to reiterate, the governor and the members sitting in the legislature don't ultimately set the price that students are going to face in the higher ed marketplace over the long term. Again, Mr. Chairman, I just want to be careful how I say this. In the short term, you can impact it by saying you're going to freeze tuition, or you're going to put in enough money to get a deal from the institutions that they'll freeze tuition. But once you walk away from that immediate deal, over the long term, there does not appear to be much correlation between where the price gets set. So the institutions are in a marketplace, the students and families are in a marketplace, and your ability to control that marketplace is probably less than you would like it to be.
Representative Winkler.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Pogemiller, it's interesting. I just had a hearing this morning and heard from Steve Hine at Deed, who compared the actual reality of jobs in Minnesota today with what this Georgetown study has called for. And I think it's sort of surprising. 70% of the jobs in Minnesota require only a high school diploma or less. And according to Georgetown, if they're to be believed, in 5 years that will switch to have 70% require something post-high school, and they went through the methodology. My concern, frankly, is that we are misleading a generation of students into believing that they need types of education or amounts of education that are not consistent with the job market. And that we have a culture of raising expectations about what education will lead to and what it will deliver in their lives, and we are getting students into situations where they believe it's essential to get various types of degrees, and when in fact they can often start work without that. But so we can't control the prices, but we at the same time seem to be in a situation in which the buyers of higher education feel like they have no choice but to buy. So we can't control the price like you can with a regulated utility or a monopoly, and yet the monopoly is out there and the market is captured and they feel they have no choice but to buy. And we are, if we can't figure out a way out of that problem, we are just perpetuating a level of, and by the way, that with tuition that high and debt loads that high, you're removing the ability of students to be able to make mistakes because the consequences of a mistake are so expensive. So we have to get our arms around this. If you can't say we set the price, I think we can. But it would take a determined focus over a long period of time for us to do that, and I guess that's a political question. I think functionally we could do it. The question is whether we have the persistence and the political will to continue on that path.
Director Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, I agree with almost everything you just said, except Minsky, I think they mentioned this while they were here. They just had 55 gatherings around the state, listening sessions, where they met with employers. And the observation, I think, is that employers do want higher educated people with more liberal education than we consider a high school diploma to be. And at the same time, many of them want them with specific skills. So I think we got two things going on here at once. They want more education by more people, higher levels for creativity, thinking, working in groups, innovation, etc. But they also want some specific skills for their particular market niche at this moment in time. And you've got your higher ed stakeholders, your institutions, trying to accommodate all that. This is the alignment issue that Chancellor Rosenstone is talking about. And so that's the only slight change I would say. I don't buy the argument that we are convincing people they need more education than they really need, because I think what the marketplace is saying, they need that education, otherwise they're going to get outbid by somebody who has one. That's what's going on. And I think if you think in terms of your own child, don't you always choose more education is probably better than less?
Unless it's law school.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pogemiller, I think the individual instances can cause you to make policy judgments that aren't necessarily valid. And if you talk to, you know, and I'm sure you do, but I mean in the case of Deed, there's also a lot of research indicating that employers have unrealistic expectations about what kind of employees they can get. And people refer to it as the job posting for the pink unicorn. They have this perception that because candidates are so desperate for work and the job market is so much in favor of the employer that they can ask for anything,
yes,
and that there may need to be some adjustment on the part of employers about what their expectations are.
Director Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, absolutely. In a down economy, that's the phenomenon you see. But we know from the demographics that within 3 or 4 or 5 years, we're going to have a shortage of educated workforce, and that will stunt the economy. That's what the Georgetown study is speaking to. It's saying you have a relative to other states in the country, we have a relatively high-level economy in terms of the necessity for highly educated people. And if we don't figure out a way to close the learning gap in the K-12 system and get more of those students attained either associate degrees, baccalaureates, or specific credentials, we're going to stunt our economy. That's what's going on all at once here.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, final comment. That Georgetown study surveys the education levels that people have in various occupations. 67% of Minnesotans working in retail have some post-high school education. And in the Georgetown study, they've led that to the conclusion that in Minnesota, 67% of the jobs require retail jobs require post-high school. And what they're in many ways measuring is underemployment, people who are more qualified than the positions they hold.
Yeah.
And then they're projecting that growth into future years. So they're projecting that we need to have many more people who have post-high school education in order to work in retail jobs. And that obviously would not make a lot of sense for us to invest money in.
Director Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, I think maybe we're heading in the same direction here. It's not necessarily everybody has to have the same baccalaureate. It's that they have to have some kind of post-secondary attainment that is significantly more than a high school, what we currently view as capacities at a high school diploma. Because again, what Minskew found, it's not the first time in this series of hearings or listening sessions, they found that employers expect a much more what we would soft skill or liberally educated worker than they used to expect. It's not enough just to be a machinist. You need to be a machinist who can work in groups, who can innovate, and who can adapt to change. And that's what we commonly view as kind of the soft skills or the liberal arts. So you're going to need a combination of these things all at once. I think we're heading the same direction there. I'm not sure. You think we might still be over-educating, but I don't think that's where the data leads us.
Mr. Chair, I don't think
we're
over-educating. I think in many cases we're miseducating, and we are misleading students because we don't have enough information about the kinds of things they should be studying, which is leading them to get the wrong kinds, spending the wrong money.
And Mr. Chairman, that's what this 11 through 14 redesign is about, to try to get that more closely aligned with what both people's aspirations are, but also what the reality is of the workforce.
Representative Fitzsimmons, you've been waiting very patiently.
Thank you. I enjoying the discussion. I think in line with what Director Polgemiller is saying, and I just feel the need to call it out because we've just been getting so much information in this committee, so it can get difficult to weed through. But on the slide 6 that you had up, I think just previously, and just looking to make sure we don't repeat maybe what hasn't worked in the past, between 94 and 99, there was an increase in appropriations at the state level of around $2,000 per student, but the spread between that and the total revenue remained essentially $4,000, and so there was a increase in money, but it seems that the spread, essentially the student cost, stayed the same. So what may have been directed as I wasn't around, obviously, but what may have been directed as something to address a tuition issue or a debt issue didn't really seem to have that. And I think just the cautionary note, too, is the total revenue on the didn't, though it followed on the appropriation up, doesn't exactly follow on the appropriation down. And so a short-term influx of appropriation may create a sticky price point that actually exacerbates a long-term problem rather than a solution. So that's just a note. I could be wrong, but I want to make that point.
Ms. Grimes, you want to respond?
No, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering if you might want to proceed to some of the other information about student debt and so forth.
Now, I'm just going to comment on Director Pogemiller's most recent comments. You're presenting us with somewhat of a conundrum when you say we as policymakers have very little lasting impact on what's happening here fiscally in higher ed, and yet the governor is proposing $240 million in new funding for higher ed, and for that he raises $3.7 billion. Those are extraordinary numbers. In fact, the most extraordinary we've had in probably a decade. So if we have little or no impact, that's a fairly high price tag to put on it. Director Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, I think what I was trying to say was I do think you have impact. I just don't think you have that much impact on setting the price of tuition fees. And that's why I think a combination of financial aid to students and institutional support for things that they do uniquely is probably the kind of balancing act that you have to consider. And like, take the University of Minnesota research. They uniquely, at least with basic research, Minsky I know does some applied research, but in terms of what we commonly view as the research function for the state, the University of Minnesota uniquely does that, and I think you do you will impact whether they're going to be a major research institution by your state appropriations to them. I do think that matters. For Minsky, they are the closest group to the workforce of the higher ed sector in some respects because of the two-year colleges. And helping them with everything I hear when I go out and talk to students in this last 6 months is that to get a job, you basically need an internship to get a job. You need to prove that you can do the job before someone's going to hire you to do it. And so I think the Minsky's approach of trying to help there in internships and apprenticeships is well thought out. In implementation, I'm certain you want to be careful how it gets implemented, but the notion is correct. And then I think to the extent that Minsky has to purchase machinery to stay relevant in the workforce, that seems like an appropriate investment. So, Mr. Chairman, I do think you have an impact. The governor and the legislature has an impact. It's just that I don't think you impact the price that's being set as much as you would like.
Well, Director Pogemiller, we met before session. And when we met with the university and with Minsky and the other entities, and both of the caucuses met in my office, we are looking with the legislative auditor at statutory language on ongoing reporting on what the systems get and how it is spent. And we are asking for your assistance in that so that we can have some type of a handle on what's happened here. And I hesitated, but we're going to have to start from here and move forward. So I think it is important that as policymakers and appropriators, we know what's going on and we can look back and quantify it. Because as I'm looking at all of this, I don't see that happening over the last few years. Grunhagen, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, is there any accountability on what happens to the money that the state gives? I mean, do we ever get a report back and say, well, this money from the state was used for this purpose? Is there anything?
Representative Grunhagen, that's what I'm looking for the legislative auditor to help us craft. Okay. That would be in the omnibus higher education bill. Okay. And this goes back to other similar things that were in various other eras. So I'd like to go back to that. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for the time, but Representative Pogemiller, so what you're saying is the taxpayers have to help students pay for tuition. Taxpayers have to help fund the institution. The institutions will charge whatever they want. And among the things that we cannot impact is how much it costs to attend a university or private college. And if we can't do that, I don't understand why we would bother with the other things. Why wouldn't we just privatize them?
Director
Why would we just let them go to become private nonprofits?
Mr. Director Pogemiller.
You had two things going on there. I want to make it clear. I don't think you're helpless as policymakers. I just think you need to be thoughtful about where you can impact and can't impact. And I don't think you want to totally privatize it because part of post-secondary is a pretty significant public good. And that's why you invest in it. And I just pointed out the two things that I think are most obvious about the public good, and one is at the university it's the research function, which is not being done by the private sector, and at Minsky it's the only set of institutions that's basically open enrollment. Not even the for-profits are in open enrollment anymore. They're trying to control their enrollment so that they are able to meet federal requirements in terms of the graduation and workforce. But so I think those two things alone, uniquely in our public institutions, are very much worth investing in by the taxpayers because of the public aspect of post-secondary institutions. I hope that was responsive.
Representative Winkler.
It's a market, but there are obviously things in that market that are uniquely public that we should be paying attention to, that I would suggest you can impact and do impact.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, it just sounds like we're along for the ride. We're forced to just pay whatever we need to pay in order to get the public goods we want, and we have no control whatsoever how much that costs. And if we were going to do that in business subsidies, we would say no. If we were going to do that in other public institutions, we'd say no. So why should we do it for higher ed?
Mr. Chairman?
Director Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, I don't think you're doing it for higher ed. I think you're doing it for access to something that citizens need. And by and large, you're paying for access to post-secondary education that if it was left to just a free market all by itself, a lot of people would not have access. And that's why we do things like state grant programs or pay for public institutions to support things that the marketplace is not taking care of. And I think open enrollment would be one of the things the marketplace would not take care of, and I think the research function is something that the marketplace would not take care of.
And Director Pogemiller, that would lead us to access and affordability in a number of ways. Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question, since we're spending a lot of time on tuition. In your information that we're going to be hearing today, are you coming back another day? Will you have some comparisons with other states as how we're comparing? Because we are in a competitive business, whether it's education or whatever. And are we out of whack when it comes to other states? I guess that's the question.
We'll pull out a chart for Ms. Chairman.
Yes.
We'll pull out a chart here, but we can get that kind of information. I think the bottom line is Minnesota, we tend to be a little higher income state, and we tend to have a little higher prices, I think, is the way to think about it.
Ms. Grimes.
Mr. Chairman, on page 15 in the spiral-bound Minnesota Measures book is a chart that shows what the published tuition and fees are for Minnesota, our peer states, and the nation. Now, our peer states are the other states in the Big Ten, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. So that gives you an idea there on page 15 how tuition and fees in Minnesota compare.
Representative Nornes?
This is what I'm looking for. Okay. Appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wondered, I thumbed through here quickly, and it may be here and I missed it, so perhaps you can tell me. As we look at this type of information, it would be helpful to me to know of the state grant money, the funds that the state is providing to help open this marketplace up, how much of it is going to the for-profits, the not-for-profit privates?
Yes. Let's find a chart. For
Director Pogemiller, I think that's part of your ongoing presentation, but that's okay. Representative Norton.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Grimes.
That Meredith Fergus has it in her
presentation
that will be toward the end of when we get done with this one.
Members, we've allotted 2 days for this, realizing that there's a lot of information here, and it is directly pertinent to students. So, Representative Norton, does that speak?
Thank you. I'll just wait for the presentation, and they can go into it later.
Ms. Grant.
You can look at page 35 of this one if you want right now.
Director Pogemiller, page 35. You're talking about page 35 of your document or of the spiral?
Yes. The one that's a state grant.
The state grants. All right. There you go.
I think, Mr. Chairman, if the staff
Director
is
Pogemiller.
Able to get through some of these presentations, a lot of these will be,
we'll
get to them.
We'll do our best. Representative Norton, did you have another question?
I think this is page is what I was looking for to find out where the state grant money that is state taxpayer dollars that I would think we could be using on state institutions is going, and it looks like about 40% of it is going outside of our state institutions. And I know there's a huge philosophical argument about whether we should be using state dollars for private schools, but it does seem like in this time of crisis, this is something we should be reevaluating. So just was trying to get a perspective, and thank you for the information.
Ms. Grimes, are you ready to charge ahead?
Mr. Chairman, on slide 7 of the one that says post-secondary education in Minnesota is a chart that looks at overall what Minnesota students and their families are spending on post-secondary education. This is aggregate, adding everybody up and multiplying times the number enrolled and all that. That comes to came to $6.77 billion in 2011. This does not count the appropriations. This is what the students and their families are paying. Of that amount, 78%, $5.3 billion, is in the two parts of this chart that are red and green. The red part came from students and families that they paid from, you know, current income from work and some from savings. And the green part, where the arrow is pointing to, is student and family loans that people took out to help them pay. Then the other parts at the bottom here are state government grants, federal government grants, and post-secondary institution grants that were also used to help students pay for the price of post-secondary education. And then this chart, slide 8, tracks since 2000 the growth in loans and grants. Now, grants include scholarships. And the pink parts of the chart are various kinds of loans. And the greenish-gray parts of the chart are various kinds of grants. And you can see that the big increase has been back then in loans, particularly in recent years, since the federal government raised borrowing limits.
Ms. Grimes, just for the members, too, you put Minnesota Measures, page 37, so there is some documentation behind the chart for the members to take a look at if you want to know how those graphs were developed. And it is helpful. Thank you for putting that on the slide. That's very helpful. Ms. Grimes.
You're welcome. Okay, so then slide 9, this is the aggregate amount Minnesota undergraduates received in student loans in 2010-11. And if you look at the total amounts on the bottom line, the parts circled in red are federal. So this is where we come up with the idea that 87% of all the student loans that are going to Minnesota students are coming from the federal government. Then slide 10 shows that Minnesota students graduating with bachelor's degrees are more likely to have student loans and borrowed somewhat larger amounts than students nationally or, again, in the peer states. Now, these data come from an organization called collegeinsight.org, which produces the data and runs a related website called the Project on Student Debt. In their report, however, they indicate that the same institutions do not report data every year. In fact, about 12% of students report one year and not the next. In addition, the Project on Student Debt data do not have information about borrowing at for-profit institutions or at two-year institutions. So the Office of Higher Education collected information on that.
Stay there for a second. Okay. Representative Swizinski has a question. That's where you're going?
Yeah.
You have your answer? All right.
Well, I think we're going to get
there. Okay. All right.
So if you go to slide 11... this is the first piece of information. Now, there is the individual data. It's actually graphed on the next slide, slide 12. We can go back to slide 11 anytime anybody wants to talk about the numbers.
Ms. Grimes, was this the group that produced the report in October of last year on student debt? And that was rather widely reported, and it was down to each of the campuses of the MinSCU system, the University of Minnesota, and the privates? You're nodding your head yes.
Mr. Chairman, yes, the Project on Student Debt report comes out usually in October every fall, and it was widely publicized this past fall, and it does provide information by institution for public institutions and for private not-for-profits, but no one else.
All right, okay, proceed.
Okay, so in the data the office collected, I'm going to go ahead to slide 12, but we can go back to slide 11 if people want to talk about the particular numbers.
So, Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, so the data now that she's going to talk about is data that we went directly to the institutions to get and tried to make it apples to apples across institutions. And as she mentioned, the Project on Student Debt, not everything is apples to apples because it's done on a national level. Here we're trying to get it as close to real as possible.
Yes, Ms. Grimes, and I believe we had about a two-hour meeting in my office going over all of this, and I'm very appreciative of the fact that you pulled it together in this way, because the data that was presented in October was rather startling. When you took a look at the individual campus and then the totality of the debt, and I think the quantifying you've done, members should pay close attention to, because it does break it down in a much more, unfortunately, familiar way in some instances. Ms. Grimes.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. So the first set of data we're looking at here is on certificates. These are sub-baccalaureate certificates that tend to be anywhere from 6 months to 18 months long, and they tend to be in programs such as truck driving, construction trades, cosmetology, massage therapy, those kinds of programs. The size of the circles here are relative to the number of degrees awarded of that type by that sector. Okay, so on the left-hand axis here, that shows the cumulative amount borrowed from all sources, federal, state, private, whatever. And on the bottom axis, it shows the percent with loans. At the Minsky two-year institution, 48% of those who got certificates had loans. And the average amount was a little over $10,000. At the private for-profits, 92% had loans, and the average cumulative amount for those with loans was a little over $12,000. And the reason the circle is smaller for the private for-profits is that they gave out fewer certificates. So it's sort of, that's the way this particular chart works. So that is the story for the sub-baccalaureate certificates. Then we move on to associate degrees. Again, here are the numbers, but I'm going to go right ahead to the chart. We can always go back to the numbers if people want to. And for associate degrees, the size of the circles show you that the largest provider of associate degrees is the public two-year sector, the Minsky Community and Technical Colleges. The private for-profits provide provide associate degrees, and then the private not-for-profits provide a relatively small number in comparison to the number provided by the public two-years. And again, you can see the relative levels of debt there. Now, ideally, in an ideal world, on this chart, the circles would be down towards the left-hand corner, where we would have relatively low amounts of debt and relatively small percentages of people borrowing. So the closer we are to the top right-hand corner, sort of the more thing there is to worry about with debt, and the closer to the left-hand corner, the less there is to worry about.
And Ms. Grimes, this is 2010, so it's likely that this would be larger if we were looking at 2012?
Mr. Chairman, perhaps. However, there has been quite a lot of publicity during this financial downturn about the dangers of overborrowing, and so it may be that borrowing has stabilized somewhat. We just do not have the data yet.
All right. Thank you. Representative Norton.
Just quickly, Mr. Chair, thank you. So are these students in the certificate and the associate degree, are they also eligible for state grants or not?
Ms. Grimes.
Yes, they are.
And so what we're seeing here is, thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for not going through the chair. So what we're seeing here is debt load in addition to state grants, which the other chart just showed disproportionately let's just say maybe not disproportionately, maybe that's fair, but a good chunk of the state grant money is going to the private for-profit and not-for-profits. But despite that, we still have larger amounts of debt by smaller students being impacted. Am I,
Ms. Grimes,
summarizing that right?
Representative Norton, we do have some data that was from a particular data set in 2008 that indicated that students who got state grants borrowed less than students who did not. But keep in mind that about 1 out of 3 students get state grants, whereas large percentages, 60% and up, of students tend to borrow student loans. So not every student who's taking out a loan would have gotten a Pell Grant or a state grant.
Yes.
Representative Norton.
Yeah, and I would say I appreciate that. Yes.
Representative Norton.
Yeah, and I would say I appreciate that clarification. And yet still, the results are showing an aggregate amount, and the aggregate amount should be impacted by those grants in the aggregate, and still we see the disproportionate expenditures.
Ms. Grimes, these are all by a degree recipients. Would you have any numbers on students who did not graduate in their debt?
Mr. Chairman, we have some national data on that will be coming up.
Is that specific to Minnesota or just national?
Mr. Chairman, we do not have data that's specific to Minnesota on that at this time.
Ms. Grimes, considering the amount of time you've spent with this, and again, hypotheticals, But it would appear by looking at this that if you've raised this type of debt and you got your degree and you stopped at some point and did not, you could be sitting on a significant amount of debt without a degree. And you'd still be in a situation where you're looking for a job or trying to get a job or raising a family and all the rest of it. Ms. Grimes.
Mr. Chairman, that is certainly possible. Skipping ahead to slide 20, this is data on students who left without a degree. This is national data, but I have no reason to believe the pattern would be different in Minnesota. And this shows that nearly half, this was data for a national stratified random sample of students who started in 2004 and were followed up in 2009. And nearly half of those who left without a degree borrowed in only 1 year, and the average was $6,600. Then another 29% borrowed in 2 years, and so their average was $11,000. There are some students who borrowed rather large amounts in leaving without a degree, but the vast majority of the students will have just borrowed in 1 or 2 years.
Ms. Grimes, why don't we have this for Minnesota? It isn't reported in this state, or the schools don't keep it, or what's the...
Mr. Chair, it is rather extensive to collect student-by-student data this way. The federal government has something called the National Postsecondary Student Aid Study, and Minnesota was fortunate enough, partly through the efforts of our office, to be oversampled in 2004 and 2008. They only do that survey every 4 years, so that we had some Minnesota-specific data for them. But they were not willing to oversample Minnesota for 2012.
All right. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when we're looking at these average numbers, Ms. Grimes, are we looking at the mean or the median?
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Grimes.
Good question. These are averages. These are the mean. These are the mean. The data that Minsky was presenting was median data, where half borrowed that much or more and half borrowed that much.
Do you have median numbers?
Representative Johnson.
You can, sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I could probably get them for this data set because this one is a national data set. In the data the office collected this year, we collected average. We did not collect median. The next time we collect the data, we hope to also collect median in addition.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, would you anticipate much of a difference?
Ms. Grimes. There does tend to be, the average tends to be a little higher than the median because a few students who borrow very large amounts of money can pull an average up.
Representative Johnson.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Director Hogan Miller?
For smaller data sets.
Yes.
For large data sets, they're probably pretty close.
Right. Okay, now I'm going to go to bachelor's degrees.
I'm sorry, where are you?
I'm on bachelor's degrees, so I'm slides 15 and 16. Okay. All right, this one is a little odd because the circles overlap each other. At Minsky State University, 71% had loans, and the average was a little over $24,800 in cumulative debt. And this is an average for those with loans. This does not include those who did not borrow. These averages do not include those who did not borrow. At the University of Minnesota, 67% had loans, and the average was a little under $27,000, and you can see the other amounts there. I was not surprised to see this cluster in the $25,000 to $29,000 range because of federal borrowing limits. The federal government limits the amount students can borrow each year and the amount they can borrow overall for undergraduate borrowing. It's $5,500 in year one, and then it increases to where it's $7,500 a year in years three, four, and beyond. And then there's a cap on it of $31,000 for dependent students. One of the reasons the private for-profit average amount is higher is that more of those students are independent students, and the borrowing limits are higher for independent students who have to rely on their own resources and don't have a parent that is helping them pay.
Representative Brenner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Grimes, how many students do not borrow? What's the percentage of?
Ms. Grimes.
Well, it's the inverse of these percentages, so it's about 30%, 25 to 30%, because this shows the percent who borrow, so the percent who do not borrow is...
Yeah, Ms. Grimes, we're moving just a little fast and flipping back and forth, but on page 15, those percentages, there are significant numbers that borrow, almost three-quarters that are borrowing money. So that's a huge number. Representative Swiezinski.
Mr. Chair, the kind of question goes a little bit earlier to the conversation we were talking about federal loans and then cost driving. Do Do you, you know, we kind of touched on when it comes to public institutions that we maybe it was hard to analyze whether or not the ability for public loans from the federal side was driving tuition increases because of that inverse effect. From a private institution, I think you maybe kind of just answered that question that do you think that that's possible? That, I mean, when you see you look at the costs for private, not, or I should say, private for-profit institutions. There's a little bit, is there, do you see a little bit more of a correlation there between those two, or availability of loans and tuition for that specific group?
Ms. Grimes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Switzinski, the research indicates that it's not as much of a correlation as people would think. I mean, it makes sense that student loans may have facilitated tuition increases. It's hard to believe that they didn't. But the various researchers who have looked at this have not typically found a strong relationship between either grants or loans and tuition. Institutions pick their tuition price based on a whole number of factors, including that some concern at private institutions that if they're too much less expensive than their main competition, people might perceive them to be of lower quality. And so some of those institutions may charge a higher price and then provide more money in institutional grants as an offset for that.
Representative Swazinski.
I think there was a study, Mr. Chair, I think Purdue University did that about 8 years ago. I think they brought some sort of a person in that said, hey, you need to just increase your tuition, and it made a difference when it came to people applying and coming into their school. One other question that I was leaning towards was kind of just that, you know, we have a lot of bills being dropped in the House when it comes to banking, finance, and home ownership. When it comes to the consultation and the ability to pay loans, the ability to create a revenue stream, income, to pay that debt over time. Do you feel a need for there to be that same conversation when it comes to the taking of loans, when it comes to conversations between a counselor, a loan officer, and the student loans? Because, I mean, if you're, you know, I was just talking to Bud here, talking about he's got a relative that may be taking on about $60,000 a year in payments for higher ed. When it comes to ability to pay with the ability to find work and the earnings of that specific degree, do you think that there should be some of those conversations happening? I'm leading you here, so feel free to just blow it off. But but you see what I'm getting when it comes to that ability to pay, ability to create an income stream as far as an income to pay off those loans.
Ms. Grant.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Swazinski, certainly the federal government tries to make people take those things into account. They require an enormous amount of disclosure, and students are required to go through something called entrance counseling before they can take out a loan. However, it is far too common for students to simply click accept, accept, accept through all the slides involved in that and say, you know, just tell me what I have to do to get my loan. There are various proposals out there trying to increase people's awareness of what it's like for them to take out a loan and what it may be like to repay. And one of the most interesting ones to me is some research that indicates that as a rule of thumb, students should not borrow more in total than they will earn their first year on the job they're intending to get. And in recent years, average earnings for people coming out of college with a bachelor's degree have been in the $35,000 to $40,000 range, and so that might indicate that should be something of a limit many families might want to encounter. In our agency's self-loan program, which is used by students who need to borrow more than they can from the federal loans, we have a quiz that nearly all students take. Institutions have some choice as to whether to make the students take it. And you have to know the terms and conditions of the loans rather specifically in order to be able to get one of our self-loans. Yet, if you flunk the quiz, you don't get the loan. And I tell this story on my poor son all the time. But my son is getting a master's degree in business at the Carlson School at the University of Minnesota in their evening program. And he thought he could pass the quiz without reading the stuff because he's my son and he'd heard about the program from me over the years, and he flunked the quiz. Because you have to know quite specifically the terms and conditions of what you're getting into in order to pass the quiz. So there are efforts underway, but we're one of few states that I know of that has tried something like making people pass a quiz before they can get a loan.
Ms. Grimes, do you have data going back 6 years or 10 years about these percentages and loans? You've got data for almost everything that goes back almost a decade. Do you have that type of data here?
Mr. Chairman, I thought you might ask that question, and I'm just trying to find out where I wrote it down. I know back in 2004, using the Project on Student Debt data and looking at students who were getting bachelor's degrees, the average amount borrowed then was $19,600, so it was substantially lower, but it was also in 71 or 72%. The percent who borrow really hasn't changed a lot over the years.
But the totals, Ms. Grimes, have.
Have, yes.
Okay. Representative, was there somebody was wanted a question? No. All right. Proceed. Unless that did not answer, Representative Swinton, are you?
Yeah, okay.
You can continue to lead all you want. It's okay. We're looking for leadership. And proceed.
And then looking at master's degrees, slide 17 and 18, this shows that the University of Minnesota and the private not-for-profits are rather large providers of master's degrees. And you can see that the amount borrowed for master's degrees have sort of ranged from about $26,000 to $36,000 in that regard. Now, this slide is a companion to the one we looked at before that showed how much students were borrowing by how many years they had borrowed if they left without a degree. This, again, is the national data, but it shows percent who left without a degree who had borrowed. And overall, it's about half, but it varies substantially by sector. I might just caution you that one of the reasons the percent who borrow is so low in the public two-year institutions is that out of about 20 million undergraduates in the United States, a million of them are in California community colleges, where the fees, they're not allowed to call it tuition, are less than $1,000 a year.
I think what we'll do is pause here. And Representative Durrell, do you have a motion?
That the minutes of February 26th and 27th be approved.
Representative Durrell moves the minutes of those two dates. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Members, if you would leave everything in your packet, please, so that we can pick it up here. And Director Pogemiller and Ms. Grimes and Ms. Fergus, thank you. We'll start here on Wednesday. Thank you. Meeting is adjourned.